The Grade Cricketer is a Twitter stream. It's about playing cricket at the grade level.
It's a tough, mean, dirty, dirty business being a grade cricketer.
A lot of cricketers, you know, that's all they know. They've done it since they're 10 and they have a deep-seated fear of change.
But the grade cricket is all about being the most alpha version of yourself as possible at all costs and at all times.
I don't bat or bowl. I just feel the gully, count the number of dot balls in a row, sledge 15-year-olds, make me feel better about myself.
Thanks champ.
Oh, no, you called me champ.
Hello and welcome to the Great Cricketer Podcast on Fox Sports. The first test has been and gone. We're going to be speaking about everything that happened at the Gabba, and wow, there's a lot of things that happened at the Gabba. Australia obviously won by 10 wickets, but that's only half the story because the Bairstow Bancroft headbutt, the Moeen Ali line situation, even though he was fucking out. We're going to be looking forward to Adelaide. Will McPherson is on the line from the Times. What's happening with Ben Stokes? He's come down under, but he's in New Zealand. It's not really down under, is it? Injuries to Anderson, injuries to Ali. Jake Ball, is he going to play ever again? Chris Rogers, a very special guest. Chris Rogers joins us. Hashtag AskTGC. My name is Ian Higgins. Sam Perry and Dave Edwards join me. Welcome, lads. How did you enjoy the first test match?
Oh, very much so, Higo. So, welcome and thanks for that intro as well. Mm. I was giddy. I was giddy on Monday morning walking into the office here in the UK. I have to admit, more giddy than a 32-year-old should be. And that's a 32-year-old millennial for the person who debated me that on Twitter. But I digress because there are so many storylines out of this test, aren't there, Higo? We have to be really careful not to dive into it too much. A huge result for Australia. Everyone agreed how important the opening exchanges would be. Australia by 10 wickets. Obviously, it was a bit closer than that, which gives England some heart. Can I just say, in like, just for some historical reference, the selections, we have to confess, were perfect. The there was fewer about the selections, but they were perfect, were they not?
They were very good, Pez, and it's good to be with you boys today for the podcast. Look, they got it right, didn't they? We hate to say that, but they got them right, and that being Marsh and Bancroft. We'll get to Bancroft in a moment because, wow, what an introduction to Test cricket and the public sphere in general. But, yeah, Australia won by 10 wickets. I've always said that Australia will win this series 6-0, and I know that it's a five-test series, but now I reckon it could be 8-0. I don't care if there's only five tests. This has the potential to get really ugly really quickly.
Absolutely, Dave. I completely agree. I just thought it was wonderful, just from my own perspective, just to have the cricket back on. And it just really reminded me of the great thing about Test cricket especially, but also just any form of cricket, except for really the Big Bash, is that you can just sort of float in and out of the room. It can just be on, and you can sort of just enjoy it in that respect. I was just so disappointed with how that test match finished. Obviously, like, I want my team to win, but more so I just want a really good series, and I just think it's fucked now. Like, England were winning that game for 3 days. They were winning for 3 days, and it looked like a brilliant test match. Mm. And they, like, Australia was struggling. Sean Marsh batted well, and Steve Smith was obviously the difference between the two sides. But like, it looked so good, and then we've won by 10 wickets, and it's fucked. Sam,
yeah.
thanks for playing me in like a good rhythm guitarist on a bad Skype connection. It's funny you say that, actually, because I get the sense from you guys that, like, and this is probably the vibe in Australia. It's not the case in London, I think. I mean, there's like this silent resignation, I feel, in England about this series. But there is also hope for a couple of reasons. Firstly, Adelaide, you know, England could not ask for a better next test match in terms of the conditions they're going to get in Adelaide. Day-night test, grassy wicket, sideways movement, a bit of swing, Broad and Anderson. They also are very much excited about Stokes coming back into the fold. We'll ask Will McPherson about that later. I wanted to ask you guys a question, though. There was a fair bit of consternation for the first 3 days of the test match, you know, in Australian terms. You could, you know, before Steve Smith's majestic dad border like runs, dad, everything was amazing. I can't stop saying dad with the way he scored that 100. You could almost see an alternative future, like a parallel universe where Australia could have been in a major crisis if he hadn't done it. And all of the usual reflexes and excuses started to come out. We started to think about, particularly, why Kevin Mitchell Jr. had created this like ride oval third grade wicket, which was low and slow and did nothing to like advance any of our strengths as a team. And you know, so the question I put to you is a slow wicket a bad wicket, or was this slow food kind of test cricket at 2.5 and over a good thing?
Look, I mean, I think we just were expecting fireworks from the get-go, weren't we? The Gabba, green top, Kevin Mitchell's last test match at the Gabba. What's he going to do? Of course he's going to give us what we want. Give us what we want. We want fast balls. We want bounces, people ducking, people in trouble, Englishmen in trouble. And as we look ahead to Adelaide, you know, that's going to present challenges as well. And I actually saw in the headlines today, Darren Lehman's warned England to expect more bounces in Adelaide. And I think this is just going to be a running theme at every ground. More bounces at Adelaide, more at the Wacker or wherever they play these days in Western Australia. Adelaide was the quickest wicket in Australia last year, I found out today. Shocked me. But apparently Adelaide is the new Wacker. So I just don't know what's going on with Australian pitches anymore. But Pez, as you say, the first 3 days, we were just waiting for something to happen. And thankfully it did. But yeah, need more bounces at heads, I think.
I think we will eventually get to Adelaide, but just the I mean, obviously everyone's talking about, you know, swinging ball, Broad, Anderson. Like Cummins, Stark is also a fair trade off for the Australian side. But let's stay on Brisbane for the moment. And it was a weird wicket. I think I mean, Richard Hines was obviously very pleased on Twitter with how slow the batting was, how slow the wicket was. It did look good for 3 days, then it quickened up a bit, and there's capitulation. I wasn't that pleased with. Let's talk about though the Moeen Ali dismissal, chaps, and that caused a lot of controversy, and I really don't know why, because it was fucking out. It was just out. His foot was on the line. It's just out. Like there wasn't like any controversy. Yeah. There was no part of his boot behind the line, and then there was like talk about how the thickness of the no thickness of the line issues.
Yeah.
His foot was on the fucking line. It was out.
Mate, you are livid about this.
I know something about the start of this. Test series has really brought out the wildness in you here. He goes about 4 swear words in the first 10 minutes.
Swear word in the intro as well.
He goes, he's riding every ball in the court and he's Warner's best mate. I mean, I think there was right to be a question over it, you know, with Moeen Ali. I mean, it was just hard to tell, wasn't it? And I think he came out and said, yeah, if I was a bowler, I would have thought it was out too. But I don't think it was like, yeah, it was just out. What's the problem?
I think the biggest the biggest shock for me, though, with this first test was finding out that they're using the Zing bales, the electronic LED Zing bales. Yeah. Like, I didn't actually think that. And I thought that the Ashes, you know, history, sacrilegion, might have been immune from that kind of T20 rubbish. To me, it's untraditional to have Zing bales in the Ashes. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I think I was reading about it a while ago. It's a great story about an Adelaide startup, Zing International, hitting the big time. And credit to the guys there for winning that business for the Ashes. But I'm just a bit scared that the Zing bales technology is the start of... what's next? You know, electronic bales now? Like, I'm worried about T20 mission creep is what I'm saying.
Yeah, you know, we talked off air about how we were going to try and find a unique angle on any of the storylines that have just been absolutely thrashed after this test. You know, unfortunately, our podcast comes out on a Thursday, so the test has been sort of run and won, and every single person under their sun has had their say. But I don't think anyone has given credit to the startup, the Adelaide startup company that did Zing Bales. I feel like with this test match, boys, that we were so worried at the start because we had all this pre-match hype box stuff around how alpha we were going to be. It was just going to be a barrage of bouncers, bodyline 2.0, you know, trio of fast bowlers. England would be scared. We want to cause them trouble. They're meek and genteel. All the old stereotypes were there. Then we just saw this 2.5 and over snail-like pace where England was dismissing our batsmen with well-thought-out, cunning plans. Yeah. And it started to get a little bit scary, but eventually the alphadom took over, didn't it? There was Zing bales. There was a bloke proposing to his, you know, fiancé, now wife, in the Gabba pool in budgie smugglers. Yeah. Like, the Australian stereotype eventually took over. And then, you know, we eventually got bouncers and broad out hooking and
bears. It always does, and, you know.
Yeah.
Nice guys finish last.
It arm wrestled its way to Australian alphadom, and it couldn't have been capped off any better than the way Cameron Bancroft described the Johnny Bairstow situation. Can we please talk about that a little bit? Because I'm not sure there's been a story like more in our wheelhouse than what has happened with Bairstow. I mean, this is like This is grade A alpha playbook from Australia. I don't even know where to start with this. Like, I was, again, so giddy on Monday morning, he goes, talking to you about this, like, laughing so much. He has tried, either socially awkwardly or in an alpha style, to alpha the debutante, who wasn't a debutante yet. He's held on to the story for 4 weeks, clearly walked into the Australian dressing room, Bancroft, told them, and they have held on to it. I just feel like I've seen this story play out in grade cricket so many times. And they've waited for the perfect moment for the debutante to come in and absolutely, like, annihilate and humiliate this player. Like, Bairstow looked like he had bags under his eyes. And can I just say one thing? Like, I have never seen a guy like Steve Smith or any captain, any leader in sport corpse. Yes. The way Steve Smith corpsed in that press conference.
He lost
And like, I just felt like there was something really meta about it going on. Like, it was not just surface level laughing. Like, he was in disbelief that he was watching this debutante just deadpan humiliate a socially awkward guy. Like, this debutante alpha flipped Bairstow and has branded him a rare unit for life.
Like, it's coming back from it. It's life.
Like, I've never seen anything more savage. Nah. I know Fox Sports like to say savage, possibly savage too much if you're listening, Fox Sports. But like, that was savagery of branding someone a rare unit on a world stage by a debutante. I have to hand it to Bancroft.
I mean, he's now just imprinted himself as the alpha dog and the youngest alpha dog that I can remember in the Australian team. I just can't remember anyone making such an impact on debut. And you say grade cricket, at the grade cricket level, at any cricket level. And I'm not talking about his performance at all, which was good. He hit some runs and did some good stuff. But just everything else, he took balls to the face, balls to the box. He courted controversy. He gave a funny press conference. Obviously, Cricket Australia will immediately send him to some kind of accelerated media training to rid him of his personality. but is he the larrikin Australia needs right now? I mean, Warner and Steve Smith are very corporate. Usman Khawaja's quite cool and trendy. Pacemen are all quite similar. They even look kind of similar. And I guess Nathan Lyon's having to take up the larrikin mantle a little bit at the moment. But maybe Bancroft is kind of the classic throwback that we need. Maybe.
So I wonder if the reaction of Steve Smith, Sam, I'll ask you this specifically, if his reaction was just the culmination of plans coming together, because this happened like a month before the test match and Bancroft wasn't necessarily in the frame. And we sort of wrote about this on our article with Fox Sports this week, and that the unfolding from Bairstow's perspective when the initial headbutt happened, when he leaned in with his head that night and collected with Cameron Bancroft's head, he was just headbutting a bloke who plays a bit of shield. But he would have seen it all just unfold. Now, all of a sudden, Matt Renshaw is out of favour. Now he's out of favour. Now they're looking for a new opening bat. Then Bancroft goes and scores runs against the Australian team / New South Wales bowling attack. And then he scores a double hundred. And then Bairstow's world just crumbling down. He sees the team picked. Fuck, I headbutted that bloke in a bar. And he looked at me weirdly and he thought that was Yowf with me back. And they're going to say something. Did Bairstow tell anyone about this? Did Bairstow tell Jarrod, lads, I've got an issue here because something happened. You guys might not have seen this, but like something happened in the bar that night. And then the world's just crumbled. And then it's all come crashing down the third innings of that test match.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. Like if Bancroft wasn't playing in the Ashes, would we have ever heard of this story? Probably not. I mean, how many other headbutts have there been on tour? Do we only hear the ones that involve Test cricketers? Like, how many civilians have been headbutted and bashed by English cricketers?
I'm shaking my head, like, copiously here because, like, we still don't know what happened. I cannot conceive of what this thing was that Bairstow was doing.
And there's no grainy CCTV footage either.
Yeah, like,
there's no CCTV
footage. And this is... You know, Dave, you were kind of coming at it from like a marketing corporate comms angle as well. Like, I do think England missed a trick by trying to kind of spin their way out of it by saying, look, their heads met, their heads clashed, there was head contact, but there was no malice in it. I think we've made it clear, let's move on. No, we need an actual reenactment of it, preferably with Bairstow. I feel like part of me feels so... I feel sorry for him because his own press are now starting to explain his actions as someone who's socially awkward, and someone kind of invoked Alan Partridge as a as someone to kind of understand, like, he wants to be a bloke, but he's not. And, like, in Australia, yeah. I mean, that is just, like, money for old jam. And I think that, you know, to answer your question, he goes, of which there, I think there was 60 in there. Like, I think that's why Steve Smith was laughing, because, like, this was the perfect storm of an alpha flip. And nobody does that better than Australia. And, like, you can feel the English press seethe about this, because they're the ones who are meant to be clever, and they've fallen, like, prey to this old Australian trope of just trying to make someone seem weird in cricket. And it's lowbrow, and it's, like...
It works, though.
It's bad, but it works, and they've done it, like, hook, line, and sinker. It's, like, look, the only... From a corporate comms point of view, what Bairstow needs to do is this, if you're listening, Johnny. A, come on the show and explain yourself. Please, let's start that campaign. Genuinely, like, give him a voice. But also, B, there was a scene with, like, Wayne Rooney a couple of years ago, if people who follow Premier League remember this. He got done for, like, there was some expose about him boxing midweek and hitting somebody. And there was this huge furor about his aggression and his drinking or whatever. He went out on Saturday, scored a goal, and then threw a couple of punches and fell over as part of his celebration. And the humour of it just killed it. Bairstow needs 100, and after he scores that 100, he needs to shadow headbutt someone, or just headbutt someone, like his teammate, or Bancroft, and it'll be over. Yeah. He'll kill it.
That.
Has to meet it with humour, doesn't he? There's no other way to get out of this.
It's the only way he's going to kill it. Otherwise, he will hear about it for the rest of his life.
Oh, Pez, that's really good. Also, what a great Ashes moment that'd be, you know? Like, what a brilliant story that'd be, like, full circle. Like, we often speak about narratives in Ashes series, but that'd just be the greatest one. Also, it means that an Englishman scored runs, in which case they might be doing well in the series. So that's really ultimately what we want. Do you guys want to speculate about what Bairstow was doing? Was he just flogged?
Yeah,
Do you want to speculate?
Yeah, I want to speculate. Yeah, why not? Why not? Because it could be inaccurate or wrong. I go with the Partridge explanation. Like, he's trying to be cool, but he's not cool. And he's sort of thought that it was cool to, like, semi-headbutt someone to say hello. He wanted to semi-show dominance. And and basically this debutante, this young guy, has just been miffed by it and has completely flipped it on him. Yeah.
I heard that it was like a rugby thing. I played a bit of rugby. I don't remember... And in England, I played a bit of rugby there as well. I never came across this custom.
Can't let it go until we see what he meant. Can't let it go.
Is the big thing that he didn't take into account that apparently Bancroft's got the biggest head in the WA side, which meaning that he's got a bigger head than Mitchell Marsh is astounding.
Wasn't it just comic genius from Bancroft? Like, that's what I want to say about him.
Perfect, Pez.
You know, we haven't really... You know, there's a lot of... former and current Australian cricketers who fancy themselves as comics. I don't think I've seen anyone with the delivery of Bancroft ever.
Mate, like, Rodney Hogg's all right.
That's a good point, Hoggy. Can't wait to have you on.
Don't forget Hoggy.
Like, but his, I think Will McPherson actually might have something to say about this, because he was at the press conference. But you could tell by Bancroft's delivery and the fact that, like, Smith was absolutely corpsing, losing it at the interview, and Bancroft was just staring straight ahead, dead-eyed, delivering his stuff. And, you know, number one rule of comedy, Saturday Night Live, whatever, is just, don't laugh at your own jokes.
All right. Will McPherson's going to come up next, and he's going to be telling us all about Adelaide.
Here in Life Matters, it's Amanda Smith with you, along with Ian Higgins and Dave Edwards, two of the three people, along with Sam Perry, behind The Grade Cricketer. It started as a persona on Twitter that was wildly popular, so the three of them wrote the novel The Grade Cricketer, and now a second novel out just in time for the cricket season, this one called Tea and No Sympathy. And what is getting champed? Can you explain that?
I don't think I had ever really come across the term, like, being referred to as champ until grade cricket. And I was telling this story the other day, actually, and it was my first game of grade cricket, and I got dismissed LBW by a 53-year-old bank manager who gave me a send-off.
I haven't thought about it since.
It was only 14 years ago. And then someone ran past me and said, yeah, pack 'em champ. And I hadn't heard that, but now it's funny because it's now so deeply into the lexicon that I'm 99% convinced that my barista thinks that that's my actual name. You know, like when you go and get a coffee, Amanda, and they say, they might not say it, it's like every guy I've ever seen, though. Have a good day, champ.
Yeah, here's your weak skim latte, champ.
Lads, we've got Will McPherson on the line. Will's joined the show before. He's writing for The Times in England, hoping to get the UK view from him. Will, welcome back to the Great Cricketer, mate. How did you find Brisbane?
It was great, thank you. Yeah, I actually spent nearly 3 weeks in Queensland, all in. So I feel like I've eaten enough steak to last a lifetime.
Yeah, I wasn't too convinced by you saying it was great. Thanks. Probably because of England's loss, but I know you're a lot more objective than that. Can you give us the England view following the 10-wicket defeat? I mean, what's the sense in the press pack from you guys? What's the sense in the England side? I mean, there seems to be a question between, you know, whether they're remaining positive because they almost outplayed Australia for the first 3 days. They certainly outthought Australia, but then obviously that was backed by a reasonably heavy defeat in the end and the alphaing of Bairstow.
Yeah, it was a funny few days. I mean, England go 1-0 down at the Gabba and the press pack immediately turned, thoughts turned to one word, whitewash, get very nervous about that. But I think in the camp, things are a bit more optimistic, actually. They're trying to take much more from those first 3 days than they are from the last four sessions of the game. Mm-hmm. But really, I mean, a 10-wicket defeat to 10-wicket defeat, however well you fought for the first 3 days and however many plans they tried, they couldn't get Smith out. And that's a massive problem. They're not going to win many series if they can't work out a way to get the opposition's number four out. They're quite optimistic. I think they are relieved that this game coming up in Adelaide this weekend is a day-nighter because they think they see that as a bit more of a leveller, even though Australia have got a great record in these games and all that. I think they do think their bowlers should come into a little bit more. So, I mean, it's more optimistic than it might be. It's certainly more optimistic than it was in 2013-14.
Yeah, good stuff, mate. It's a bit of a distraction, I would have thought, the whole Stokes thing. And I personally just cannot keep up with the news cycle at the moment. Like, people are saying the other day, for example, he was on his way to Australia and then he was on his way to New Zealand and then he was seen in his full England kit at the airport. Someone says something on Twitter, someone's photographed doing something controversial, spirals into six Brett Jeeves think pieces on Fox Sports. I just can't keep up personally.
But also, Go on, mate. Sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, like, Stokes, summarise where England are at right now in regards to that. I mean, I understand he might not play, perhaps until the third test, perhaps not at all, but just where are you getting any kind of what's the rumour mill doing at the moment where you are?
Well, basically, England's stance is it's fairly firm for now in that they're waiting for Somerset and Avon Police, a police force that none of us cared about a few months ago and are now the most important things in our lives. But we're waiting for them to make a decision on whether they're going to charge Stokes. It's expected that they're going to make that decision very soon, at which, while they haven't been making a decision, life's been quite easy for the ECB because they've just been able to sit back and go, oh, yeah, but, they haven't made a decision on charging him, so how can we do anything? And that's a pretty reasonable standpoint. The problem is they're going to make that decision very soon, perhaps today in the UK. So the time we're talking is Wednesday evening, Australia time, so maybe Wednesday in the UK today. They might make that decision then, make it public, and then the ECB has something to decide. They've allowed him to go to New Zealand, where he obviously has family, and what initially we were told was a family trip, a bit of golf, he's saying, he's practicing his golf swing, that kind of stuff, has now turned into him being given a no objection certificate to play abroad, which is basically the thing that all overseas, all players need to play overseas. So he's got one, and it looks like he's signing to play for Canterbury, who have a game on Sunday. So he could be playing cricket as soon as Sunday. And in fact, I expect him to be playing cricket on Sunday. But he's still banned by England. I think my impression is that there's been a softening of the stance in recent days.
Yeah.
Now, why that would be, who knows? But that is the impression I get, that they are more open to him coming to play in Perth, say.
Yeah.
Or Melbourne. It may be too late by then, but Perth, say, than they were a week ago. And possibly because they're 1-0 down. Possibly because they're a bit peeved. I don't know. But I didn't think it was possible a week ago, and now I do think it is.
Really? Possible. I mean, mate, like, hasn't it been reasonably understood without being officially confirmed that Stokes would play in Perth? Now, you just can't answer that, I understand. But it seems like awfully convenient to me that we did think he was going to play in Perth. He's now flown over to New Zealand to get a bit of match practice. You know, it maybe stands to reason. I mean, the great question with all of this has been, what has taken the police so long? I know there's been something said about a new witness coming forward, etc. But, like, just, you know, with a conspiracy hat on, it sounds to me like the timing of the police no charge call coming in the next few days is actually perfect for England. Because if they'd announced it earlier that there was no charge against him, he would have opened himself up and England cricket up to sort of 2 or 3 weeks of moral posturing from Australia. If they just announce it quickly, he's already in New Zealand and he can just fly over in readiness immediately for the next test, it actually works perfectly. So I guess what I'm saying is it's hard to take that there's been this recent softening. I mean, surely he's just always been ready to go and everyone has been supportive of that.
Well, the word is, I don't think the ECB have been that supportive of it, to be honest, but the word is that he's been sort of banging his head against the wall, particularly since the test started. Like, he really struggled being sat at home watching the test. He was apparently living his life on Brisbane time last week, watching every single minute. He's been doing some naughty, he's been Instagramming his naughty boy nets and things like that. He's absolutely driving himself bananas, not being able to play. So, which is, I think is why he's moved so fast on the to get himself over to Christchurch. It was all really quick. I think he basically, his people spoke to the ECB on Friday about the possibility of a no objection certificate to play abroad, but they didn't quite appreciate that he might want one by Monday to actually be getting on a plane. And there he was. It's all been, the timing is all, you mentioned timing. I mean, the timing of the whole thing has been remarkable. So The Sun released the video of him, or allegedly of him, throwing a few, you know, swinging from the hip on a night out the day the England squad got announced. The Sun then found the two crucial witnesses and published the interview with them the day that England arrived in Australia. It's all just been so well timed, the whole thing. So this is just the latest case. You know, we're just 2 weeks out from a test that everyone expected, sort of was jokingly saying he would play in. Now here he is in the right hemisphere, ready to go.
Yeah,
having had a bit of cricket. England also have a 2-day warm up match in Perth at Richardson Park in South Perth, which we went to before. They have that between the second and third test. And there's just some, you know, the conspiracy theorists are saying, are pretty certain he'll play in that, which would be an absolute circus if he did. It'd be very funny.
Yeah, I think funny is the word at this point. I mean, I think to fly over to New Zealand and then not play would be more remarkable than him playing at all. But I think he will. Can we just talk about the cricket that actually was played, though, quickly, Will? I just want to talk about two England players, Wokes and Jake Ball. You know,
yeah.
Ball especially looked like a, not at the level. I understand Wokes might have a little bit more to offer, particularly in Adelaide. But, you know, from an ignorant Australian standpoint, they looked like the sort of bowlers that come over here to Australia and while they might do well at first-class cricket, are not at the level. I mean, is that just classic Australian complacency?
I think England actually got things wrong picking Ball. So he he has had an injury. He's been out for a couple of weeks leading into the test, and this bloke Craig Overton, who I'm not at all biased over because he's a Times columnist, but he did well in the warm-ups, or at least he was very solid, and I think they should have picked him because they knew he was fit. And Ball just looked, you know, Ball was bowling a bad ball and over. And the England's whole strategy is getting wickets through drying up runs. It's like they did in 2010, you know, being really tight. And Broad and Anderson were brilliant at that. Wokes didn't get, well, he only got one wicket in the game, but he at least was pretty tight. I think he was going under 2.5, whereas Ball just couldn't keep things tight. So he is a worry. I would be personally surprised if he plays in Adelaide this weekend. And then Wokes, yeah, Wokes, I mean, Wokes had a poor test match. The problem with Wokes is that he's sort of England's safest pair of hands, but he's probably about half the cricketer he is overseas than in English conditions, both with bat and ball. You know, so he's got 9 first-class tons at county level, but overseas he doesn't look as anywhere near as good a batsman. His bowling is a bit, with the Kookaburra ball particularly, a bit gun barrel straight. So he's a slight worry. But I think he'll be fine, actually. I think he'll do well in Adelaide.
And just finally, mates, you were at the famous press conference with Cam Bancroft and Steve Smith, I understand. You know, what was that like? You know, can you give... I mean, that just seemed like the most extraordinary thing in comedic terms when it comes to Australian sport, which is traditionally thinks it's very funny, but it's actually not. It's actually seemed to be very, very funny. I mean, what was that like to be at?
Well, we can't believe our luck because, and I can't wait for next Monday because, Monday last week, Nathan Lyon came out all guns blazing, telling us how he's going to end careers. Matt Pryor was a coward, all the rest. That was brilliant. And then this Monday, we got the Cam Bancroft show, which was absolutely hilarious. I mean, it was a bit of a PR disaster for England. They put Johnny Bairstow up and he didn't he spoke but didn't answer any questions and didn't actually say whether his head had made contact with Bancroft. And then Bayliss was, you know, he's many things, but he's not he's not sort of a statesman or a diplomat, and he struggled with the questions he was asked. And then Joe Root, brilliantly, this was possibly my favourite moment of the whole thing. Joe Root, having just watched the other two fumble through their bits, Joe Root got on stage and said, well, you know, they've told you exactly what happened, so I don't think I need to answer any questions on it. They'd done many things, but they certainly hadn't told us what had happened. And then, so it was left to Bancroft to deliver his assessment of what happened. And to be honest, from my point of view, it was a bit of a relief, because it meant that Bairstow hadn't, you know, given him the full Glasgow kiss. But it was very, very funny. It was one of the great hours, actually. After watching England bowl for about 70 minutes on the final morning, without even so much as a half chance, to watch them the next 70 minutes was some of the greatest of my life. So that was quite good fun.
And Will, just finally, it's been a huge week for England, and by that I'm referring to Prince Harry's engagement to Suits actress Meghan Markle. What's the general feeling among Brits regarding this union? Positive, largely?
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of gingers on the agenda, aren't there? A lot of gingers on the
agenda. It's a
natural
segue from Bairstow, yeah.
Stokesy, Bairstow and Prince Harry. I mean, he's another one who's punching, isn't he?
Oh, got it. Well done.
That one's been doing the rounds, I bet.
Yeah,
among English types.
I don't know, actually. I think I'm going to take credit for it, but I imagine someone else said it.
Will, thanks for joining us again and providing the UK view. I try and do it from here, but I'm clearly overwhelmingly biased and have a chip on my shoulder as a colonial. So it's really good to have you on, and all the best for Adelaide. Hope you enjoy it, mate, and we'll touch base with you soon.
My pleasure. Speak soon, guys. Bye.
The Great Cricketer, Tea and No Sympathy, put together by Dave Edwards, Sam Perry, Ian Higgins.
one of the most important things about any form of cricket is lying. You know, you have to lie about your batting average. You have to lie about how many runs you scored on the weekend. You have to lie if you drop that catch, if it bounces in front of you. Does that carry? Yeah, definitely carry. Yeah. Definitely carry.
It's a centerpiece of cricket.
And you have to lie to your wife. You know, if there's a bit of drizzle around and the game's been called off on a Friday night, you still pack your kit and you go to the game on Sunday morning because you're going straight on the circuit with the boys.
Yeah.
It's dog eat dog.
Yeah.
It's Darwinism. Great cricket is basically Darwin. Survival of the fittest.
Well, the great experienced club veterans don't exist in great cricket anymore. They're gone.
Club veterans 23 years old.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Second year university.
Still trying to work out their best foot.
Yeah, finishing his arts degree. Yeah.
Finding your sexuality.
So, just in a line or two, what great cricket's all about.
It's about being very aware that it's just a feudal system. First graders to the top of the land, the kings and the barons of the world. Oh. Peasants are fifth grade and everyone else is just trying to stay relevant.
Oh, outstanding. I love
it. Okay, boys, the next guest is going to be familiar to many of our listeners. He's been on the show before. I just wanted to start with a quick story. When I picked him up in the car to speak with him last season, he looked a little bit disappointed. I wasn't sure if it was the car or not. It was actually my wife's car at the time. It was Volkswagen. I thought it was pretty good. But he looked disappointed, and I didn't know why. 2 months later, we were lucky enough to have a beer with him at the SCG, and he confirmed that he was simply disappointed that he was stuck with me for the interview and not the three of us. Because it wasn't as funny. So wholeheartedly alphaed by him in front of my colleagues and in front of the grandstand team. So you might get a sense of who this is. But the man we have got on, he does wear many capes. He's a former test opening batsman, star commentator, Australia A coach. He does really seem to love cricket. But despite scoring something in the vicinity of 18 billion well-earned first-class runs, he was also described by Ian Healy on air, on Channel 9, that is, as the player whose on-field style was completely different to his off-field brand. It's our great pleasure to welcome Chris Buck Rogers onto the Great Cricketer. Bucky, what did Ian mean by that remark?
Well, I've no idea. You'd have to ask him, I'd say. But thanks for having me. I think I was disappointed there wasn't the three of you last time, but you're leading me to believe now there's only two of you as Higo's dropped out anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
He might pop back on at any time, mate. Yeah. Just be prepared for like a really incongruous question out of nowhere.
Yeah, this isn't a reverse alpha, but it's just really bad Skype connections.
Yeah, just shit internet, yeah.
But yeah, we've gone behind the fourth wall there. Can we, I mean, before we get into just the quid pro quo about you on the circuit, Buck, you actually are like a wonderful cricket analyst, I will say. So can we talk a bit about the cricket that's just been? Ultimately, Australia has recorded a convincing win. But I wanted to get your views on just how far ahead or not they are. I mean, from a personal view, I thought a couple of the batsmen were dismissed with well-thought-out plans from England. You're thinking about Khawaja and Hanscom there. I thought Stark was so-so, you know, with the new ball. Are Australia as far ahead as our media are leading us to now believe, or is it a bit closer?
Well, I think the worrying sign for England is they held their own for 3 days, but, you know, well, once Australia kind of put the pressure on, they just completely fell away. So I kind of think Australia will be pretty confident. And, yeah, I feel that they are a long way ahead. I was probably before the series thinking it was going to be a close one, maybe a 3-2 to Australia. But then you listen to Ricky Ponting and say it was going to be a 4-0. So that made me automatically question myself. But yeah, from what I've seen, I wouldn't say Ricky's wrong by any stretch of the imagination.
Do you think there's any questions that remain with regards to the Australia top order, though? I mean, I say that off the back of like a 180-run unbeaten partnership to secure a 10-wicket victory. But I do think, I mean, personally, and I'm no cricket analyst, but there was that kind of, you know, sense of foreboding in the first couple of days that it could all just fall apart at any moment, that kind of collapse, you know, triggering memories of Hobart last season. Are there any questions still with regards to the top order?
Yeah, there's got to be. I mean, there's going to be harder challenges for Cam Bancroft than the second innings he had. But he looked like he could play. That was excellent, his innings. I feel the way he plays, it might find it harder in Adelaide where the ball will swing both ways a bit more. England look like they have a bit of a plan for him already. And then Usman Khawaja, well, the issue with him, the ongoing issue with spin, that kind of remains to be seen how he's going to counter that. And Pete Hanscom, I think, needs to be aware of exactly what the plan is England going to do. They're going to bowl back of a length and then try and fire one full. So he knows. I think I spoke to him about it. I don't know about you boys, but every now and again you don't strap that back pad on tight enough, and you just clip that back pad and then you
all too often.
Straight one. So that was his excuse to me. I quite liked it.
See, he's saying he got out because he didn't strap his pads properly.
Yeah.
Well, that's his excuse, but there was some good bowling there by England, but they just fell away. And then that second innings, when they needed to really, you know, give something, particularly at the start, they looked like they had about three or four overs in them and then they were done. So that's a bit worrying for them.
I know what you mean there, Buck. There was this sense that England kind of overachieved for the first 3 days. They played out of their skin. Every plan worked for them. You know, a lot of their guys that were expected not to score runs actually stood up, although they probably needed one person to go on with it. And even with that scenario where everyone seemed to be playing well, they still found themselves slightly behind. And that must have been a little bit demoralising for them, that when they're at their best, it's still a massive arm wrestle. And then as soon as they drop off, they, as you said, capitulated.
Yeah, I think the one thing for them is that they've got Joe Root, who you'd expect to probably go and get a big score sooner rather than later. Alistair Cook gave nothing in the first test. They're the two big players. I have a feeling they'll change the batting lineup as well. I think Johnny Bairstow needs to go up the order. I'd put him as high as five because I think he's their second best batsman. So there's still some hope for them, and particularly in this test match. And the other thing is that, you know, that I still don't understand why they picked Jake Boyd. He hadn't bowled a ball in a competitive match since he rolled his ankle a couple of weeks before. So he was off the pace. So I reckon they'll probably have a bit better balanced side this second test.
Just keeping it nerdy and on the cricket before we talk about circuit. I just wanted a question about Alistair Cook, just from your personal perspective. It's silly to even ask you to suggest that he's lost something. He's 32, he's fit, he's one of England's greatest ever batsmen. But I just wondered whether, from a personal perspective, you know, whether his, you know, does the mindset change as you get a little bit older as an opener, you know, when you kind of nick off at the start of the series or you're imprecise with a hook shot, you know, a couple of minutes before stumps, you know, you may have been in a similar situation. You know, what, I know you can't read his mind and say what's going through it, but I mean, is it worth asking a question there about how he responds from that? Should we be worried about him?
I think there'll be a few concerns about him, only because he's played 140 test matches. It's so hard to comprehend. You know, I played nowhere near that amount, and by the kind of end of my stint, I was pretty exhausted, you know. So if you actually look at a lot of guys who play a lot of tests, they tend to retire early, just because it wears you down. And I wonder if just having to fight every innings he goes out is just getting a little bit tough, because he's that kind of player. It's not like he goes out and he middles them from ball one and he does it easily. He's got to fight as hard as he can every innings. And sometimes when you get to the back end of your career, that gets harder and harder. So that would be my only concern. I mean, he's still a champion, you know. He's one of the statistically the best ever opening batsman. You can't write him off, and for the series and for him too, it'd be great to see him come back and you know, play, have a good second test, but also for the rest of the series.
Chris, can you tell us about when you were playing, the meetings before the game for the Australian team? I'm just in relation to obviously Cameron Bancroft and the whole sledging headbutt thing. Like, did you guys have meetings about how you were going to sledge certain players? Like, basically what I'm asking is, did the Australians hold on to this information about the headbutt for like three and a half, four days before they were going to unleash it on Johnny Bairstow? Is that a thing that would have happened?
My guess is Davey Warner had just forgotten the first innings, but there you go. But
just blurted it.
But I don't know, to be honest. I find it hard to kind of understand why they did it in the second innings and not the first innings. You know, they've all got their own, their motivations. I think they probably would have talked about it. I mean, if they felt that was something they could use, then, you know, then they're going to go for it. I mean, it's pretty ruthless in that environment. You do want to alpha the other bloke. But, yeah, I don't
confirmed.
Know. I'm sure Davey would have absolutely loved it. He would have had a very short memory. Can't remember back to England in 2013, but even better.
Can I just confirm with you, Buck, here? Because we've been discussing how, you know, what Bancroft and the Australian guys did was just from the absolute textbook of the, you know, Australian alpha playbook. Mm-hmm. Surely, you know, when it comes to alphaing, there's nothing worse than being branded a weird bloke, which is essentially what they're doing to Bairstow. They're essentially humiliating him globally for being strange. Is that the correct read?
Mate, it probably comes with being ginger. I got to look quite a lot. But
then, oh, super sorry for him.
But yeah, I reckon he's, yeah, it's going to be an interesting one now for him. How's he react? But I know Johnny. He's a pretty laid back guy. It didn't surprise me when I found out that that's the kind of greeting he gives every now and again. He's a bit different. He's a bit out there, so...
a bit different is surely the worst thing you could be called in Australian cricket. Different.
Different. Yeah, well, being synonym for rare.
And you don't want to be different in that environment, do you? No. You get found out.
No.
Sadly.
Conformity is crucial.
Sadly. Yeah. All right, let's go into throwdowns. Buck, away from the cricket talk, I suppose it's a nice segue because we're talking about all things social. As you know, we told you this off air, and we'll tell the listeners now. Quite often we try and get some anonymous contributors to these segments. We've had it on, you know, we get the opportunity to speak with players, past and present, who know the guest, and I don't think we've ever had more contributors to you.
Can I just interrupt?
Yes.
I actually started an ex-Fran cricket club WhatsApp group, so I've already been bombarded with certain things they're going to be asked, by the way, so can't wait for this.
I actually don't think we can ask 99% of the things we were told about you, yeah. So just don't be too worried, because some of these things just aren't going to get through.
All right, here we go. All right. I think there's a couple of soft ones here, Buck. I've been instructed by a former teammate of yours, and I don't know what this means, okay? So you're going to have to help me out. I've been instructed to ask you about when you first came to the Vics and the team, including you, was in Mooloolaba in Queensland's Sunshine Coast. Is this ringing any bells just yet?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Okay. My first time with the Vic boys, it was different.
Okay.
I was different. There you go.
There we go. Different again. Well, okay. We don't want to step in yet. This is a quote, right? And I don't really know what this means, but it says, he was being a hermit and the boys kept wanting him to come out, but he stayed on his computer. And this is kind of where I don't get it. And it says, so some cricket kit might have jumped out the window. Can you explain that?
Well, we're on the second floor. I was rooming with... Brad Hodge and Andrew McDonald, but it was a three people apartment, but two bedrooms. And Hodgie and Mac are very close, so they decided to take the room together, which surprised me because I was, you know, the junior member of the side. So I got my own room, and every time I came out, they were gone. So I didn't know what to do. So I just kind of, you know, sat around doing nothing for the first few days. I thought that they didn't like me, so, you know, I was feeling, you know, a little bit out of the group. And then it wasn't until I did actually message Macca and he said come along, and it was fine after that. But yeah, they threw some of my kit out of the second story window. They thought that was pretty funny.
Cricketers.
Yeah.
And that's definitely Dave Hussey, but, you know.
Yeah. That's incorrect. It's incorrect, genuinely.
Was it?
Yep.
All right.
Buck, I'm informed that you once bought a sports car, only to realise you couldn't fit your cricket kit in it. Is there any truth to this?
Yes, I had a BMW sports car, and then, yeah, found out my cricket bag, my coffin wouldn't finish fit in the boot, so I had to put it in my passenger seat. But I'll never forget, I didn't have a sponsor at one stage, so I had to use Bass, you know, the vampire kit that they had. And they gave me these pads that they said Sachin Tendulkar used to wear, and those really, really light ones, but they were two straps. And I'll never forget Hodgie. We were playing Victoria, and Hodgie was there, and Warne was playing as well, and Hodgie just said, "Mate, how can you drive a sports car but wear those pads?" And that was his pledge to me at the time. It probably doesn't sound that funny, but it was pretty humorous. And he was putting me back in my box, that's for sure.
Did you make 250? Because you normally did that.
No, it was 270, wasn't it?
Yeah, wasn't it?
All right, Bucky. In your book, Bucking the Trend, you spoke about an incident which occurred in Sydney where a senior Western Australia player you were playing with said, "Don't you ever fucking stand next to me in a pub again." Would you have preferred that player headbutted you?
We practically did, didn't he? But there you go.
Emotionally.
Yeah. Back in my hotel room, yeah, so... No, that was a long time ago. I was a pretty cheeky young ginger kid, there were some, you know, there were proper heroes back in that side. There were legends of the game. There was, you know, there was Gilchrist and Langer and Martin and Julian and all these kind of hussy, Ryan Campbell, all these kind of guys. So I was probably should have just kept my mouth shut, I think, at that time, and then got that sledge at the Coogee Hotel. That's right. I'll never forget that one.
I like it. Just another anonymous source, Bucky, and you would never, genuinely wouldn't forget this, and I can call you Bucky, I presume. It's kind of vague. So according to this source, you were once dismissed in a WA second 11 match, whereupon you got to the change room, took off your gear, and retired to the bar for a beer. I know that's kind of, I mean, I don't know if you can, probably a long time ago. Is this source well off?
Well, seeing as you blokes have swore, that's absolute bullshit, but there you go. Yeah. Where did you got that from?
Yeah.
Can't really, who told you that one?
I can't give you
that's
sources.
That's just porky pie, that
okay.
one.
Okay.
Okay. There you go. Bucky, I was never that bad.
Just to move to your broadcasting career for a moment, Triple M has launched a rival coverage for the summer. Do you refuse to work for them because your repeated mentions of your 173 at Lords would breach their no repeat workday policy?
In fact, I have 76 stories, as I like to tell people, but you can work that one out yourself. But yeah, you got to get that story in as much as possible. You got to 100 at Lords.
Oh, classic.
Don't do that too often, but yeah. Yeah, no, I don't get the Triple M. I'm definitely not cool enough. So you got to be someone special to get there.
Yeah, Gus Warland.
Do you want to speak? I mean, speaking of your innings at Lords, do you want to talk about the ball that Graeme Swann got you out? Was that the worst ball you've ever faced in Lords in 2013? Can you talk the listeners through that dismissal?
I can. It was kind of funny because Shane Watson came up to me before that test and he said, "Buck," said, I'm never ever going to use the DRS again. So I keep getting it wrong. And I thought, smart boy. England batted first, they got 400. And then we went out to bat, Shane and I, when we were opening again. We put on about 40, I think. And then sure enough, he got hit right in the pad. Big appeal given. And at Lord, he was out the nursery, and so you have to walk past your partner to get into the pavilion. He's walking off, head down. I said, "What are you? You're going to review it?" And he looked up and he said, "Nah, mate, that's plum." I said, "No, I promise you, it's outside the line." He said, "Are you sure?" And I said, "I promise you, mate, I promise, it's outside the line, review it." And he went, "Oh, okay." So he reviewed it, much to the laughter of all the English blokes. Sure enough, red, absolutely plum. Poor bloke walked off, popped all sorts of abuse for it. So yeah. So then, anyway, then I got the full toss, and it went above the sight screen. I'll always blame the fact that I'm colourblind. It's the best excuse for it. But yeah, went above and kind of got lost in the crowd, and I knew it was high, so I thought I'd hit this for six, and I swung hard at it, missed it, and hit me flush on the box right in front. And Murray Erasmus gave me out.
Yes.
And I walked I walked all the way down to Usman Khawaja and I asked him, mate, is it out? You know, should I review? And I promise you, he did not say a word. He didn't shake his head. He didn't do anything.
No replies, even worse.
So I just walked off. So I can't review if it's going to hit my box and then it's going to hit middle halfway down. But sure enough, it was missing legs. So I think Graham Swad said it was the worst piece of cricket in Test history. So, yeah, I feel pretty proud about that one.
I love knowing about how those conversations take place on reviews because you're talking about players' careers on the line and you just have your mate say, not even speak a word to you. That is, again, to use this Fox Sports word, savage.
So I was going to say, well, it wasn't too hard to twist his rubber arm to do the review, just so you know.
Just on that note then, this is a kind of selfish question, and I'm not sure I might have asked you about this in Melbourne, but I'm red-green colourblind as well, and I just want to know if part of the problem with you succeeding as a colourblind player is that it eliminated an excuse for me to not succeed. And I just wanted to know if, like me, you ever went into an optometrist and asked whether colourblind glasses exist, because that ended up being my excuse for not ever batting in the nets because I just couldn't see the red-green hue.
No, you've got to have the sight screen. You can't play without sight screen. So I'm not sure what level you played, Sam. So, you know, if it was, in fact, D-grade suburban turf and there were no sight screen. So there you go. If that was the case, it would have been different.
Ouch. Ouch.
Anything I've achieved has now been immediately eliminated.
Once again, Perry bodied by a guest on the show. Bucky, I want to ask you, there's actually a BBC Sport video on YouTube, which I encourage all listeners and sundry to watch. It's where the Australian team are celebrating in Perth after they've reclaimed the Ashes in 2013. Chris, in that game, you took a catch, a diving catch off Tim Bresman at mid-off. It's a really good catch. And then after singing the team song on the square, you reenacted the catch with a bottle of champagne as the ball. And I just want to know which catch was more important to you. And in a word, how huge was that night out in Perth?
Oh, thanks for this. I really appreciate it. It's some of my most embarrassing moments. I think that was a couple hours after the test. So you've got to give me a little bit of leeway there. But reenacted. That was the night we all went back to Warnie's place at Crown Casino, and I actually had a dance off with Davey Warner where I destroyed him, but you know, it's not too hard. And then if that's what grown men do, and then that was when we went out that night and wouldn't get let in the casino, and Ryan Harris tweeted about it for he had a tweet up for about 15 minutes. And got himself into a lot of trouble. So that was a pretty memorable night, that's for sure.
That's good.
How does Shane Warne not get allowed into a casino? Perhaps he didn't come out with you guys.
No, he didn't come out. It was only the desperados who were still there. So that was there was about a handful of us, I think. So, and usually I'm in that crowd, but there you go. I think Ryan was definitely there. Brad Haddam would have been there because he's actually. I always had a competition to see if we could, who would be the last man standing, and I didn't get one. He had hollow legs, that guy.
Buck, fantastic! You've delivered in exactly the way that we hoped you would. Chris Rogers, for everybody who's listening, probably like one of the best and most insightful commentators in the game, and clearly a circuit specialist as well. Thanks for coming on the show, mate.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
I don't play cricket for results. I don't come to take wickets, score runs, or win games. I play cricket to look good. Rigs, chests, pipes, circuits, salads. This is my domain. So when I hit the sheds, I need to radiate success. That's why I use Chop King Cologne by TGC. With with a blend of the finest handcrafted English Willow and Kookaburra Red King Leather. Chop King Cologne lets me radiate cricket. Whatever the ground, whatever the circuit. Chop King Cologne. The new fragrance for men by TGC. Reek of runs without hitting them.
That was the voice of Chris Rogers, friend of the show, just like everyone else. Fantastic to have Chris on. And before that, Will McPherson, just a nice, polite English chap, and he's funny as well, and we like him. Just a reminder, in case this is your first time ever listening to us, Tea and No Sympathy is out in bookstores right now. We want you to get it right now because don't wait till Christmas, because last time we sold so many books on Christmas Eve that there were no books anymore. And I don't want that to happen to you people. Because at the end of the day, the podcast people are the favourite people, aren't I, chaps? Like, we really
people
we like
were so angry at us and at our publisher for doing that. So we switched publishers so you won't have that problem this time.
Hello, Dave.
So it's out in all bookstores. You can get it in Big W. You can get it in Dimmicks. You can get it online. I don't understand the people who write to us say, where do you get your book? Because the amount of time you take to write that to us, you could literally just Google where to get the book from.
Yeah.
It's Tea and No Sympathy. We highly recommend getting it before Christmas because we know it's on a lot of people's Christmas wish list. You might want to do it now. So do it now. Hashtag ICGC, gentlemen. Favourite time of the week when we get to connect with these lovely people out there. Are you guys ready to go? We've got some questions lined up. Let's start with Nathan, who says, Dear TGC, interesting to see Magellan Financial Group sponsoring the group from Benton and Hedges and VB. What does sponsorship from a medium-sized boutique funds management company say about the direction of the game and at the same time, Australia?
That's a great fit, isn't it? I mean, investing is kind of like gambling, so it's kind of just a slightly more highbrow version of a sports bet ad. I'm genuinely interested in learning more about Magellan, though. Like, I'm sick of getting weak returns from investing in local companies. Like, the mining boom is over. Fucking BHP's flailing. Telstra's down. Give me some of that fucking sweet high-yield US tech stock. Magellan.
If you're listening, sponsor Magellan. Yeah, doesn't it just reflect the... you get a unique view from over here in the UK. Like, a lot of my social media feeds looking at friends at home are very much about, like, acquiring property and investing in things and generally just being upwardly socially mobile. And I suppose that's what Magellan offers. It believes that cricket fans are in that realm too, whereas 20 years ago they just wanted to smoke Benson and Hedges and drink VB. Maybe we could ask James Sutherland if he'd like to come back on the show.
Explain your corporate sponsorship policies.
Barry McKenzie asks, great cricketer, what business does a Portuguese explorer from the 16th century have sponsoring the Ashes? Hashtag AskTGC. Really the same question, but makes a fair point.
Yeah, should have looked at what Magellan did. But I think the joke is wrapped up in
a lot
the
of Asia. A lot of Asia.
Shane says, hashtag RCGC, g'day guys. I've spent my gap year before commencing my studies abroad initially to play a season in the UK. However, 10 years of cricketing mediocrity culminated in me quitting mid-season. Instead, I've been travelling Europe, and the year has seen me significantly improve my awareness, grow as a person, and become a far more thoughtful, selfless, and well-rounded member of society.
So
after
far,
backpacking
so good.
Through Europe, I took up a gig in Barcelona volunteering to give back. Mm-hmm. Having awoken one particular morning, I was instantly alarmed to see a message from a former clubmate back home. However, not from one of my good mates as per usual, but from a pipeless, leaverless, 26-year-old virgin that has a career batting average of 5, goes at 8 and over with the ball, is about as useful as One Nation's election strategist in the field, and has zero social capital. Having processed that a third-team AstroTurf country cricketer that is yuck personified was trying to interact with me, my eyes sharply focused on the message. Hey, champ, the greeting that pierced my eyes and molested my soul. Alfred, by a virgin, utterly fucked. My question is, do you think he really sent me the message, or was it Russian hackers' latest attempt to peddle propaganda for an economically and socially closed world as being championed by President Trump? After all, the interconnected world that has arisen courtesy of free trade and liberal economic policy has enabled me to be champed from 13,000 kilometres away. If this is not the case, I resign myself to being his submissive for the remainder of my days, even if he does bat with a $30 kookaburra he bought off eBay. Kindest regards, Shane. P.S., love your podcast. The only reason I'm coming back to Australia is to buy your new book.
Well, Shane, thank you very much. Mm. It's a scary world we live in, isn't it, when particularly through this Russian propaganda, we now have champ bots. I mean, let's call them for what they are. They're champ bots.
Champ bots.
And if you do get... I certainly get plenty of champ bots in my text feed as well. It seems like every friend of mine wants to call me champ. Now I have to... You'd think that if you kind of started the lexicon that people wouldn't do it to you, like if people understood, but it feels like more people champ me and us than ever before. I don't know where they think... What grounds they think they can do that on. But nevertheless, champ bots... Well said, Shannon, and an alarming but an important message.
Dave, are you getting champed more or less than when you joined TGC?
It's probably more, but it's always everyone's aware that I know the word, and the word is connotated ironic, to TGC, so it's laced with irony, But I still don't like it. Stop doing it.
Aiden Beard says, "G'day, fellas. I tried searching for you on Google and into TGC, but was surprised to find that instead of the Great Cricketer, search results returned the Gospel Coalition." That's just great. "This organisation has a Wikipedia page and a verified Twitter account, clearly demonstrating their higher status in the social hierarchy of searchable acronyms. According to their website, the Coalition, and I quote, seeks to serve the local community by providing gospel-centred and Christ-focused content.
Same as us.
My question is, do you feel guilty wasting the hashtag AskTGC on mediocre cricketers whose lives are probably devoid of value at this point, rather than allowing it to be used by people seeking to find meaning in their lives through a connection with their Lord and Saviour, Jesus Christ? Hashtag AskTGC. Hashtag hypocrisy."
Fantastic. Another brilliant question from Aiden Beard. The first thing I would say is that religion has always had really good SEO. Search engine optimization.
You've always said that. You've always said that, Sam.
You know, I've always said that on the show.
No,
I've always
ROI.
Said it in private. I do feel like you could literally flip the words like Jesus and Christ and searching for meaning with, you know, grade cricket, and the thing would still, the question would still work. So, you know, again, we've come back to the is grade cricket bigger than Jesus question before. It's not really for me to answer. It's not for me to answer. It's for the listeners to answer.
You're just putting it out there. I actually recently bought a house, as you boys know. I'm still getting harassed by so many real estate agencies, including one called TGC Commercial, that's still sending me property alerts. Like every day I open my inbox and I get a property alert from TGC Commercial.
Yeah.
I don't know how to unsubscribe, and it's spamming my inbox massively.
You just think we've started like an umbrella company without talking to you as well, called TGC Commercial. Oh, what's this, boys? I don't know about you as well. It's like, you know, that phenomenon of buying a new car and then seeing a lot of other people with that same car as yours. I feel like that would be... companies that have the word alpha in them. Yeah. I just feel like there's so many companies and entities and organizations that just call on the term alpha.
Well, if the listeners do want to know how the book sales are going, Dave has just bought a house in Sydney. Melissa Smith writes in and says, "I'm just sending you a message as I'm really interested in buying this page from you. I can pay you according to its worth. You'll be paid complete up front through PayPal, Western Union, or money bank transfer. If you'd like to discuss it further, please just send me your reply and we'll see what we can work out. If this sounds like something good for you, please add me as a friend. Waiting for your kind response." Pez, are we going to sell the page?
Well, this is why we thought we'd ask TGC, because we want some buy-in from the listeners as to whether we should do this. I mean, we originally said yes. We said maybe about $4,000. But we're currently still kind of arm wrestling it with Melissa. I just wanted to point out that we probably get a request every week from very Russian sounding accounts to sell the page. The only condition is we have to give them the admin of the page first before they transfer us the funds. So we thought we'd put
that's
out
the only
as
thing
to what
stopping
we
us. I think the fact that we have to hand over the admin, because you never know what's going to happen from there, and it doesn't sound like it's a very trustworthy company or organization that we're dealing with Melissa Smith. Melissa's actually spelled wrong. There's no I in it. I'm not sure if I trust Melissa. It's been enjoyable stringing her along for about a month or so.
As she listens to this podcast, no doubt. Sam Johns says, "In the first over of the test, Mark Taylor twice referred to Matt Renshaw as Mark Renshaw. Was this an honest mistake, evidence of his obvious incompetence as a commentator, or a clear ploy from a once great cricketer to alpha one of the up-and-coming stars of the game while he still has the chance?"
The latter, easily.
Oh, clear ploy to Alpha. Yeah.
Clear ploy. All right. Josh Button writes, great cricketer, how will the midnight curfew affect England's test circuit?
Terribly. Obviously.
Tremendously, yeah. Yeah,
tremendously so. It's shocking, and then they've only got Bairstow to blame.
Tough to do a circuit that ends at 12. Like, I don't know if you can even call it a circuit if it has to wrap up by 12.
Well, or you could just live in Sydney, because that's what happens now. Matt Nichols says, great cricketer, as he has terrible batting shapes, do Steve Smith's test runs actually count? Or is it a case that by batting like a park cricketer and still being a gun, is he outfielding the rest of world cricket?
Look, I don't think they should not count, but I definitely think that some runs are worth more than others. Like, for example, watching Mark Waugh just hit 10 elegant runs was to me like, it was like drinking a fine scotch. Like, you savour every little sip. Like, you have it in an oversized glass, neat, obviously.
Yeah.
Like, it's almost pornographic. Yeah. Like, you really enjoy it. Whereas watching Steve Waugh hit a double ton in Jamaica, you know, is a less sensory experience. Like, I'm not watching that on YouTube at 3 a.m. I'm watching Mark Waugh hit 10.
It's like drinking your first beer the next day after having had 40 the night before. Just it's just razor blades, Steve Waugh innings. I think with Steve Smith, like there's again from the UK view, as they clutch at anything to have, you know, one up over us in the realms of cleverness and intellect. I've heard a lot of people say that while he's great and all, he's very inelegant and he doesn't look very good scoring runs. And I guess you would say that. If you did want to be a pessimist about Steve Smith, and I will be for the purposes of the show, you know how every Australian captain, or even captain from any side, gets into the twilight of their career when the eyes go? It even happened to Mark Waugh. I think particularly, Steve Waugh was just letting balls hit him. Mark Taylor just couldn't hit the ball. Even Ricky Ponting, you know, was falling over when they were bowling to him. That was a good ball, actually, from Callis, to be fair. But, like, I hold grave fears for what Steve Smith will look like when he's kind of 34, 35.
Oh, so you're looking ahead that far, yeah.
It's a shocking thing to say because he is at the absolute peak of his powers. He's scoring dad runs. He's, like, my favourite player. Don't get me wrong. I think he's fucking fantastic. But I do hold fears for what shapes he will be pulling at 34, 35 trying to play. It will go, and it will go quickly and horribly.
Unlike a Federer who's having, like, the longest twilight of any sportsman ever, just because he's just so beautiful and clean to watch, like a ballerina who plays sport.
All right, just a quick one here. Dave, I'll ask you this one. It's from Tom Hartney, hashtag RCGC. Bowling the ball into the keeper rather than throwing it. Thoughts, village or retro?
it's retro. I used to do it ironically, but when I was predominantly fielding in the ring, though. You know, great mix, often in a cordon. So I was never really far away enough to have to bowl it in from the boundary. Would look funny if I'd bowled it in from second slip. But I used to do it a few times, ironically. Courtney Walsh did it.
Courtney Walsh used to do it. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, he did. He did. Andrew Wind says, great cricketer. As all cricketers get a nickname from their mates at the club, Pez, Higos, Nugsy, etc., what's Dave done wrong?
I don't know what I've done. Pretty sure I was Edo's in season one. Can you lose a nickname? In a few weeks, you'll be calling me Mr. David Edwards, just increasingly formal.
I can shed some light on this.
Go on.
We do know the person who's written in the question, and you have outed him by calling him Andrew Wind. It's Andrew Wind, but that's fine. Windy. I'm happy with that.
It's not.
Old Windy, yeah. But we all play the same club together, and Dave did have a nickname, and I think what Andrew's getting at is that Andrew actually ascribes a nickname to Dave. It was cliche, but it was Danger. Again, asking the listeners, if we want to make this sort of Pez, Higos and Danger, please let us know. Maybe we could run a poll on it or something like that.
I don't know. I mean, like, it's weird because, as I said, I'm pretty sure I was Edo's in season one. Because Higos, we went to school together and that was my school nickname and that's what my real mates call me. So, yeah, Dave is fine for you chaps.
What do you mean season one? It sounds like a TV series.
Yeah, I'm trying to make this into like a Netflix-style situation.
That was the voice of Mr. David Edwards there. Last question. Nuno Van...
long one.
Damn. It's a long one, but stick with us. Often the best one for last. Shire/Village/... Shire/Village v. Grade debate. Dear TGC, When I first started reading your book, then tweets, then podcast religiously, I felt an instant kinship. The morally bankrupt club characters you never see between May to October, perfectly encapsulating the futility of the most time-consuming sport that has no limit for the lowest bar of fitness actually required, all couched within the mental confines of an uber-alpha meaningless sledge fest of one-upmanship. Your pros spoke to me. Become this year's podcast and the revelation of your elitist views, regrade v park yuck cricket, I felt the unnecessary sting of champdom from people I considered comrades. In your eyes, I guess I'm a park cricketer, suburban, turf, WA / as opposed to WACA. However, I'm actually talented enough to have played every grade, including first grade, through sheer force of the unbridled heat I throw down. Hence why I still feel the kinship / recognition factor of the power structure of clubs and inadequacies of the Aussie male you so artfully portray. You want to know what a park cricketer really thinks of a grade cricketer / first grader? Here it is. No matter how many wickets you take, how long you spend working pipes / rigs, how many extra throwdowns / slip machines you muster, how much social capital you earn buttering up those past prime backdoor power brokers who somehow only ever appear at 6:58 p.m. selection night with a team list handwritten in beer and tears. You think you're better than me? Mate, I dry heave after a four-over spell, likely was on the circuit from Friday night and only stopped because it's midday Saturday and non-sponsored beers aren't allowed at the ground. Have become genuine mates with some of the oddest legends from all walks of life to ever walk the planet, yet I'm 1x5-wicket haul away from replacing your soulless stock market corporate host body, and we're both just as close to representing Australia, champ. Enjoy your upstairs, pop-collared, elitist, Uni New South Wales gay bar, boys. P.S. I'm a white-collar lawyer / genuine all-rounder cricketer / bloke with 20-plus years of one-club cricket behind him, and they called him best evers. P.S. I too was enthralled by the last dad / son final story. But how the fuck did a bloke, dad, who'd presumably played zero cricket that year, even qualify for a grand final, let alone just walk into the squad? Sounds fucking village / made up to me.
Fuck.
Brilliant.
Me. Brilliant. This is all over the shop.
Yeah, like, it's kind of familiar in the sense that, like, in many ways, Nuno wants to, like, level with us and be friends, but then it just kind of alarmingly snaps into some aggressive behaviour, a la Bob Catter's comments recently. But, like, I really do... Like, I identify what Nuno's saying there. He's essentially saying that we're no better than Shire's cricketers. And what it reminds me of is, like, Dave, you remember this. Like, at university, there was a subject called Israel, Palestine and the Arab States. And what you learned was, you know, particularly with Gaza, and I'm sorry if I'm being loose with this, like, everyone really is the same and wants peace. But if you're from a particular tribe, it's just never going to happen. Yeah. It's a too hard basket. I'll always be a grade cricketer. And so long as I'm a grade cricketer, I'll always think Shires is village. And Nuno, when you say you throw down heat, that just gives you away. No one throws down anything unless you're getting throwdowns. So, you are a Shires cricketer. Thank you for your wonderful prose. Maybe in another life we'll be the same. Maybe our similarities are better than our differences, but you're a Shires cricketer and you'll always stay that way.
Yeah, absolutely. Shelbyville versus Springfield, basically.
Another show in the books. Will McPherson, Chris Rogers. A wonderful, wonderful show. If you want to join us on social media, if you don't already, I'd be surprised. But do join us on Instagram, our latest platform, at The Grade Cricketer. If you want to get in contact with us from a media perspective, or if you want us to speak at your event, to host your event, to MC your event, or to provide entertainment, the email is... greatcricketer@gmail.com. I'm going to be at Chatswood Oval this weekend commentating and on a PA for Gordon's T20 day, North Sydney and Uni New South Wales and Gordon all playing on the same day. It's Chatswood Oval this Sunday. If you want to come down, I'll sign any book. It doesn't even need to be Team No Sympathy. I'll sign the Bible, whatever you want. I'll sign anything. So come down. Thanks to producer Toby Shane. He does the ads. Adrian Long for the music, and our wonderful publisher, Alan Unwin. Adelaide, next stop. See you next week.